Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. You will often hear people opine about the meaning of life, about their morality, their personal morality. That's how we usually talk about it now, my personal morality, because it's something I can carry around with me in my back pocket, and it really doesn't have to apply to anyone else. I have mine, you have yours. People will talk about their personal truth. Very often, if you dig a little deeper, they'll say, look, the reason, and they're very consistent, at least consistent within their own system on this, they'll say, the reason I believe that my morality is mine and my truth is mine and yours is yours is because none of it really has an objective foundation. Because everything around us, including our morality, our minds, our thinking, they're all just the product of random chance over long, long periods of time, just particles and the laws of physics and enough time, and here I am with my own personal morality. Now, how do you respond to that? That's what we're talking about during this hour of Issues Etc., framing the debate in the public square. Philip Johnson is our guest. You can join us. We have a call-in number, 1-800-730-2727. If you're getting a busy signal, please keep trying because we will be freeing up phone lines here momentarily. 1-800-730-2727. We have an in-studio email address as well, issuesetc@kfuo.org. The best callers and emailers during this hour will receive a copy of Philip Johnson's book, The Right Questions. Let's talk with John. He's calling from Topeka, Kansas. John, welcome to Issues Etc.
No, thank you for taking my call. I love Dr. Phil Johnson, especially the topic of logic in public square. I hear people a lot, whenever they're talking about this issue, they always talk about there'll be the primordial soup or there'll be the Big Bang and any of the processes they use, and then they'll talk about it, and by chance, thus and such happened, and hence everything came about. The problem I have with that is that they've just equivocated on the use of the word chance because chance can't do anything. Chance is nothing. It merely describes ignorance. So I think it's a problem fundamentally with the way the debate is framed.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting point, John. Thank you for the call. Phil, your thoughts on that?
Yes. Sometimes we say that chance is the materialist's god of the gaps. When they don't have a real explanation, they just say, well, it must have been chance, which is no explanation. I think that's the point that the caller is making.
So is it true that if someone says, look, we have the stuff of the primitive universe, and given enough time through random chance, through just particles bouncing off one another, coming together in random ways, sooner or later a viable system developed that can grow in complexity, they are really, when they bring chance into it, they are really admitting to complete ignorance as to how this happened.
That is true. Although it is conceivable, of course, that some combinations of things are the result of chance. If you ask why a certain number of coins are heads or tails, that's a matter of chance. And that can be demonstrated. But where you're trying to explain something that is very complex and ordered on the basis of a chance, it usually means, well, we can't think of how it could have happened, so we'll just say chance. It's the same as an absence of explanation. But in the scientific materialist way of thinking, there are only two explanations, only two forms of explanation that are allowed because God is ruled out of the picture. And so when we're talking about how everything got created, it must either have been the result of particles just coming together by chance or else particles coming together by natural laws, law and chance. Those are the only two possibilities. Now, in our ordinary lives, we see that when something complex is created, like an automobile or a radio or a suit of clothes, It is created by an intelligence, a designer. You design something, and then the intelligence is used to put it together. However, for a scientific materialist, intelligence cannot exist until intelligence has evolved from non-intelligence by chance and natural laws. So you'll see, you'll remember my little anti-scripture in the beginning were the particles and the impersonal laws of physics. Those are the only two things that existed. So the particles can come together according to the rules of the impersonal laws or according to just chance combinations, as when they're shaken at random. So it's the force that brings them together, and they're ordered or disordered by chance or by physical laws. Now, if you followed the evidence of life, you would look at things quite differently, because even the simplest living item, a biological cell, as in a bacterium, which has only one cell, even the simplest living organism is enormously complex. In fact, it is a miniature chemical factory, something like a city with its own energy transport systems and its own repair systems to repair damage, its circulatory systems, its transport to transport the little chemical items from one end of the cell to the other where they're needed. So it is an extraordinarily complex thing that makes a spaceship or a supercomputer look rather low-tech. The natural understanding that anyone would have looking at this masterpiece of miniaturized complexity is that it must have been put together by intelligence. However, the rules of scientific materialism don't allow that. Now that there are human beings who have evolved by chance and physical laws, they say, now those human beings can have intelligence and they can do things intelligently. But before that time, there cannot have been any intelligence, because that would violate the rules of scientific materialism. In the beginning were the particles and the laws and nothing else. So you see, it's this dogma, it is these philosophical rules that govern the explanation rather than the evidence.
Mordecai is calling from Pittsburgh. Thank you for waiting and welcome to Issues Etc.
Hello. I heard that evolution had been disproved and there was evidence to show it, and also that that Darwin, like in his later years in life, actually recanted the theory of evolution. Do you have information on where I could get a book to document that?
Mordecai, I'd like to have you stay on the line if you could, so that we could send you a copy of Phil's book called The Right Questions, Truth and Meaning. Mm-hmm. And public debate. Phil, an answer to a question. Is this just hopeful thinking?
There was a real human being, a lady, Lady Hope was her name, who was present around the Darwin family in the months before Charles Darwin died. And she later published an account in which she said that Darwin had told her that he had come to doubt his theory of evolution. He had accepted Christ, and he had said that essentially he was sorry he'd ever thought of the whole thing. And so she wrote this pamphlet, and the whole Darwin family said it was not genuine. They denied that it is true, and I guess no one will ever know for sure what the truth of the matter is. So there is that account that's been widely circulated in Christian circles, but I never rely on it myself because it can't really be authenticated. You can't know for sure whether it's true or false. And as I say, the entire Darwin family denied it and said that Charles Darwin believed in his theory to the end.
But even if the account were true and Darwin did renounce his theory on his deathbed, that would not in and of itself invalidate the theory.
That's correct. It would not. What the scientific materialist, the Darwinist, would say, well, the poor old man lost his nerve on his deathbed. That's too bad, but it doesn't show that his scientific investigations were wrong. So I don't think that that's a terribly useful line of thought to pursue. The more important thing, I think, to notice is that there is not and never has been any proof that natural selection in combination with random mutation, that's the Darwinian mechanism, random mutation and natural selection, there's no evidence that this mechanism ever produced anything new, any new kind of organism or any new feature such as wings or eyes, a blood circulatory system or anything like that. It's all just fantasy. It's all just a speculative storytelling. Now, I wouldn't say that evolution has been proved false, because, you know, it's extremely hard to prove a negative. And it would be wrong to let the Darwinists make the issue as, can you prove that, you know, that no evolution has ever occurred?
We'll take a break here, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation and take your phone calls with Philip Johnson. We're talking about framing the debate in the public square. Join us at 1-800-730-2727. We'll be right back.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Can God's ways be generally understood by human reason? Is God's favor manifested in life's successes and victories? Is God pleased by sincere human effort? Hi, this is Todd Wilkin, host of Issues, Etc. You'll find answers to these questions in the latest edition of the Issues, Etc. Journal. I've written an article titled, The Theology of the Cross, Cross-Shaped Theology. The latest issue also contains articles titled The Means of Grace, A Confident and Joyful Heart by Pastor Eric Rotman, Living in Two Kingdoms, Peace or War, Order or Chaos by Pastor Mark Sell, and Craig Parton's essay From Evangelicalism to the Evangel. Plus, you'll find a list of tape and book resources. You can receive a complimentary copy of the Issues, Etc. Journal by calling our resource line at 1-800-737-0172 or write Issues, Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. We're helping you frame the debate in the public square, especially as it pertains to the prevailing naturalist view that is out there. Well, nothing could, there are no explanations beyond what we can observe in the natural world. And all the evidence is in favor of a naturalistic explanation for everything. Simply, the stuff of the universe and the natural laws, impersonal laws, no lawgiver, just the laws themselves. And there is no evidence to the contrary, we are told. This doesn't seem to be true. Philip Johnson is our guest, Professor Emeritus of Law at the University of California at Berkeley, and author of several books, including his latest, titled The Right Questions, Truth, Meaning, and Public Debate. By the way, you can get more information on this book at the following website, therightquestions.com. It's all one word, therightquestions.com. Let's go back to the phones. Gil is calling from Oakland. Gil, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Good evening. My question for Dr. Johnson is, since the evolutionists claim that reptiles evolved into mammals, that would require a tremendous change in the reproductive system. Wouldn't that change have to be accomplished and completed in one generation, not over millions of years?
That's a good question, Gil. Thank you. Phil?
It's very hard to see how you can get a tiny bit of the change in the reproductive system in each generation, because it would just mess up the reptiles' reproductive system. Would just mess up the reptile to be evolving a mammalian reproductive system, which it wasn't using yet.
At one point, you would have to have a reptile that is entirely reptile reproductively, who could somehow interbreed with the reptile that's halfway between the reptile, the halfway point between the reptile and the mammal, that could produce a succeeding generation that would be a little farther along the evolutionary chain, wouldn't you?
Yes, I guess that's true. There's no evidence that this halfway creature ever existed, so it's all just a speculation. But the reptile and the mammal are two totally different kinds of things. You know, there was a great professor at my own university a few decades ago named Goldschmidt, a famous professor of genetics, and who taught evolution, and who became so disgusted and discouraged with the lack of evidence for this gradual evolutionary process in just the example that the caller has given, that he decided to take a new approach. This Professor Goldschmidt said that he believed that the jump between the one kind of animal and another must have happened overnight. Thus, he gave the example that a snake's egg hatched, a reptile egg hatched, and a bird emerged out of it. Now, this is essentially a miracle, of course. It's not a natural event at all, and nobody's ever seen it. And Goldschmidt knew that, but he said it must have happened just this fast. Now, the rest of the evolutionary biologists wouldn't accept his solution of this overnight evolution, because they realized that it would be so incredible, their whole theory would collapse. And yet, they have never been able to demonstrate their own theory, which is the gradual step-by-step change. It hasn't been seen, and no one can understand how it could have happened. So what we have here is essentially a mythology that is coming disguised as a science, and efforts are made to teach it as fact to all young people in schools and to prevent anybody from criticizing it. We're fighting a battle all the time to get teachers the right to teach students what's wrong with theory, and to show them the great difficulty that it has in accounting for the evidence. But nowadays, teachers get fired if they try to teach the students truthfully that this theory is not well supported by the evidence.
Folks, if you were trying earlier to call in and ask a question or make a comment for our guest, Philip Johnson, we do have some phone lines open now, and you can call 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727. You can also email us, issuesetc@kfuo.org. As I said before, the best callers and emailers during this hour will receive a copy of Philip Johnson's book called The Right Questions. 1-800-730-2727. Rick is calling from Westmont, Illinois. Rick, welcome to Issues, Etc.
I was wondering, consider it says in Mark 10:6, but from the beginning of the creation, God made a male and female. When any 100 million years with animal pain and death has given Adam and Eve reason to doubt God, and what do you think of the dozens of examples of creation research society has of new lava flows showing billion-year dates, and that the ice crown plotting method, even the high-tech method, doesn't even show the initial ratios of the ice crown plots or the comparative radioisotope concentrations.
Rick, thank you very much for the call. Phil, you've got about 2 minutes here to handle those issues that Rick laid before us.
I'm sorry, but I had a little difficulty in hearing.
He had several questions. The first one, let's handle that one before we go to the break. He talked about the problem of death before Adam and Eve, the theological problem that is sometimes posed for the creationist scientist or something like that.
Well, it is a problem. This problem is one of the major reasons why many people consider it very important to stick to the young Earth scenario in the 6-day creation of Genesis. Now, if you're talking about animal death before, it's pretty hard to avoid because insects are dying, for example, just constantly, and microscopic characters. But if it's probably your reference is probably meant to a reference to a human death, and to human death, it. Is very important to for the biblical system to retain a notion that the human death came into the world as a result of sin, and not before.
When we come back from this break, we'll get to the other question that our caller posed, having to do with whether or not the dating systems that give us in the order not only of hundreds of thousands of years, but of millions and perhaps even billions of years, whether or not these dating systems are as accurate as is assumed when we hear about something, a fossil, a strata of rock, something like that being dated in these what come out to be gigantic periods of time. Think about that for a second, folks. I mean, it is rather convenient, isn't it, that I could propose a theory that something slowly changes over time, and these periods of time are so great that there's absolutely no way to measure that change during a human lifetime or even during 100 human lifetimes. You could put generation of generation after scientist on the job trying to measure the change of an organism from one thing to another, these gradual changes, and even those lifetimes wouldn't be enough to measure the beginning of the change because the periods of time are so great. Rather convenient, that theory. Something that cannot be measured, cannot be observed. When we come back from this break, we'll take more of your phone calls. 1-800-730-2727. 1-800-730-2727. I, for one, do believe in that six-day creation, that young earth. Why? For the very reason that Philip pointed out just a moment ago, and that is, Scripture's so clear. Death entered the world through the sin of one man, and in Jesus Christ, another one man is the only solution for that sin and death. We'll be right back. The pressure to compromise your ethics in business can come from almost every direction: your employer, your employees, or your customers. God never promises financial success to the ethical businessman, but do good ethics make for good business? In our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June, Christian Ethics in the Workplace, you'll find out why ethical compromise isn't necessary in business. Order your copy by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours at 1-800-325-3040. The book is $14.99 plus shipping and handling. Or order the book online at our website, issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June, Christian Ethics in the Workplace, 1-800-325-3040, issuesetc.org.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Todd Wilkin here again. I'm joined by one of the co-authors of our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June, Christian Ethics in the Workplace, Jim Truesdell. Jim, how would you respond to someone who says, look, I'm all for ethics in the workplace, but my competitor isn't, and in order to compete with him, I might have to compromise occasionally?
Well, I think if he says I might have to occasionally compromise, I would say that both from a worldly standpoint and from the long-term perspective of what is in the interest of your business, what is in the interest of you as a person, you need to forgo that occasional compromise. Think about the businesses whom people truly regard highly, the businesses that stand the long-term test. They generally are businesses who have a reputation for acting ethically, for making the long-term decisions rather than the short-term decisions just to get that order. You can think of some pharmaceutical companies who took some long-term decisions when they had some products that were adulterated in the manufacturing process, and when they got out into the marketplace, those companies made the decision to pull them immediately off the shelf, take the short-term hit to profits. And in the long term, they've gained the consumer's confidence. On the other hand, you can think of some companies, maybe in the automotive area, where there were problems developed, and the decision they made was the best short-term decision, thinking, well, all right, well, maybe the problem is not as big as we think it is. Maybe we'll just handle it on a case-by-case basis, and maybe it'll go away. Those companies have suffered harm to their reputation. So I would say, even if you're looking at things from a worldly perspective, if you make the ethical choice and you do the right thing, it's probably going to inure to your benefit. Ethics is good business, but of course we need to remember that we don't make ethical choices because ethics is good business. That's, again, looking for our selfish interest. We do the right thing because God has commanded us to do that, because we're using the gifts he's given us to our fullest in the workplace, and certainly as Christians we want to let our light shine as an example to others.
Christian Ethics in the Workplace is the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June. It's written by a theologian, a businessman, and a business school professor. You can order our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June, Christian Ethics in the Workplace, by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours at 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Or you can order the book online at our website, issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on Christian Ethics in the Workplace. It's the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June. 1-800-325-3040, issuesetc.org. Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're talking about framing the debate in the public square, especially as the questions raised by the naturalistic worldview, that explanation that says, look, there are no explanations other than what we can observe. Natural causes must explain everything. How do you enter the debate, ask and answer the right questions when that is on the other side of the table? Philip Johnson is our guest, Professor Emeritus of Law at the University of California at Berkeley, and author of several books, including his latest, The Right Questions, Truth, Meaning, and Public Debate. By the way, you can read an excerpt from this book on our website, issuesetc.org. When you get there, go to the What's New section, click on it, and you'll find an excerpt of The Right Questions. There was another question that was laid before us by a caller before the break, Phil, and that had to do with the accuracy of dating methods, especially the dating methods that render results in the millions and billions of years.
Yes. The greatest problem for the young Earth scenarios is in physics. Physics is where the radiometric dating methods come from, and also the entire Big Bang scenario of cosmology, which requires millions of years as a result of the basic mathematical calculations. Now, for this reason, I do not advise Christians who are taking these issues up to get into the age of the Earth issue right away, and to challenge the dating. It brings them into conflict with a wide range of scientific disciplines, and especially the physics of the Big Bang and astronomy. This people get in over their heads pretty quickly. And moreover, I think that the most important thing to establish in our day is the key question that you need a creator to get the creating done. We're putting almost all of our resources into arguing that issue because that is one which is very winnable. And I think the Darwinian system that says you don't need a creator to do the creating, the particles and the laws can do it all, is in deep trouble and is falling. And it's a very good idea to stick on, you know, on that subject for the time being. There are, if you want to know more about it, there are creationist scientific groups that are very active in investigating and challenging the radiometric dating evidence. The Institute for Creation Research in Southern California near San Diego has an entire group and is publishing on this the subject of problems with the radiometric dating. So you can read about that at their website. That would be icr.org. Then there's also another a young Earth creationist group, answersingenesis.org, which Answers in Genesis. Just look that up in your search engine. And they also publish a fair amount on this. I myself have been trying to build a movement that includes and in cooperating both people from the young Earth creationist world and the old Earth creationists, and to have them both concentrate on fighting the Darwinists instead of each other. So for that reason, I've been putting aside all of the questions involving the age of the Earth for the present.
Let's go back to the phones. 1-800-730-2727. 1-800-730-2727. Byron is calling from Berkeley, California. Byron, thank you for waiting, and welcome to Issues Etc.
Good evening, gentlemen. Thank you for taking my call. Can you hear me all right, sir?
Yes, we can.
Very well. Apparently, you've answered all my questions. I take it, Dr. Philip, I forgot your last name already. I've heard you many times on the radio, KFAX. You are familiar with uniformitarianism?
Yes.
You are familiar with the microbiology works of Michael Behe?
Yes.
And you're familiar with the dating, carbon dating, and so on, somewhat. I got over my head, and I've been outgunned ever since.
Well, that's why I advise people that, not to go into all of those issues at the start.
What's your question, Byron?
What has been dealt with concerning the age of light, for example, the distant galaxy stars, and the age of the universe? That's still a stumbling block. Plus blood. I don't know anything about blood, the serology theory as far as evolution is concerned.
Byron, thank you for those questions. First of all, would you define a few of the terms that he tossed out there, Philip? Uniformitarianism,
yes.
To begin
with? Well, uniformitarianism is the doctrine that all of the geological features of the Earth, like mountains and valleys and all, are the result of very slow processes, the same things we see happening every day, erosion, and the heat of, in volcanoes, for example, continuing over millions and billions of years. Uniformitarianism is contrasted with catastrophism. Catastrophism says that major features of the Earth occurred as a result of sudden, rapid catastrophes. The most spectacular catastrophe the whole subject would be the biblical flood of Noah, and of course there's a huge controversy always and has been as to whether the flood ever happened, whether it was worldwide or local, and so on. But there could be many other kinds of catastrophes besides that, and the uniformitarians would say catastrophes of any kind played no important role in the geology of the Earth.
And then he asked a question about the age of light. Why is that an important question?
Well, I think what he probably has in mind is that the cosmos is extremely large, of course, and we are seeing objects at the far end of the universe that are millions of light years away. And so it is very difficult to understand how the Earth could be less than millions of years, or the universe could be less than millions of years old, because it would take millions of years for the light to reach us from these very distant objects. And this is certainly a very big problem for the young Earth creationists to deal with.
Now, with this said, I want to return to this notion of debate, especially not only on this issue, but on all the issues that we've touched upon in the course of this long conversation. So, we just had a caller who said, look, I got into a few subjects way over my head, and in his words, he's been outgunned mm-hmm. ever since. Now, that would obviously end kind of in a fruitlessness. How would you advise just the average Christian layperson who is not an expert in science or astronomy or in geology or in biology to frame the debate when it comes to his neighbor who has bought into a purely naturalistic explanation for everything?
Now, I would not start with questions like the age of light or days of creation of Genesis, how long they were or whatever, because that is a way to get in over your head and to get deadlocked right at the start. What I would start with, I recommend starting with the right question. The right question in this case is, do you need a creator to do the creating, or can the particles and the laws do the job on their own? See, that the Darwinian theory says the particles and the laws can do the job on their own. And that is the key to the whole scientific materialist enterprise. If the laws and the particles cannot do the job, if in the beginning where the particles is not a satisfactory beginning, and you have to say in the beginning was the word, in the beginning was intelligence. You needed intelligence to do the creating of all of the life forms, then the scientific materialists are wrong on the most important point. And you have God back in the picture, and a necessary element of the picture again. That is the first question to address and the first point to be made. We can get to more difficult and complicated questions after that. But I think it's a mistake when the Christians allow themselves to be diverted into the extremely technical scientific questions instead of the basic issue of whether you need a creator to do the creating or whether you don't.
With about a minute before we go to this break, how would you respond to someone who says, look, I am a Christian and I'm wary of the introduction of some of these ideas into the classroom where my children are going to be taught, because I'm wary of any religious tenets at all being taught there. I would prefer that they just stick with the evidence and go where the evidence leads. Mm-hmm. But I do not want them bringing God into the picture, because I don't know what God they're going to be talking about in the classroom to my child.
Well, when you think about it as a matter of bringing religious doctrines into the classroom, then there is that worry. But I don't think that's the right question to be asking. We can ask the question of, do you need to have an intelligence? Do we need to invoke intelligent causes to explain the origin of life and the way that living things got to be as complex as they are today? That's not bringing religious doctrines in. That's just pointing out where the scientific evidence is headed and recognizing that fact. That's doing good science. I think it's true that we shouldn't in the public school classrooms be talking about religious doctrines, but we should be talking about where the evidence is going.
Let's talk more about that when we come back. 10 more minutes left with Philip Johnson, Professor Emeritus of Law at the University of California at Berkeley and author of the book The Right Questions, Truth, Meaning, and Public Debate, when we come back.
A voice in the wilderness of American evangelicalism. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
If you enjoy listening to Issues, Etc. on the weekends, did you know that you can listen to 12 new hours of Issues, Etc. each week on the Internet? All you have to do is go to our website, issuesetc.org, click the worldwide KFUO logo, and there you can listen to Issues, Etc. 24/7, including 12 new programs weekly. The website address again, issuesetc.org.
Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. However, we are not funded by the church body. We're also not affiliated with Lutheran Hour Ministries or the Lutheran Layman's League. Issues, Etc. is supported by listeners like you. Please help support this worldwide outreach by making a gift this week. Our address, Issues, Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Thanks for your prayerful consideration. Next week on Issues, Etc., we'll discuss the life and work of Dietrich Bonhoeffer with Dr. Ken Sherb of Zion Lutheran Church in Moberly, Missouri. Now, most of us are aware that Dietrich Bonhoeffer was involved in a failed attempt to assassinate Adolf Hitler during the Second World War. What do we know about the life, the writings, the beliefs about this German theologian of the early 20th century? Why is his influence and why is his fingerprint felt so strongly in the church today? We'll talk about that next week on Issues, Etc. with Dr. Ken Sherb. Now, if you'd like to know what we'll be discussing on Issues, Etc. for the remainder of this month, you can go to our website, issuesetc.org. There you'll find a list of topics and guests for the weeks ahead. While you're there, be sure to find additional information on the new book by Philip Johnson, our guest, called The Right Questions, there at our website, issuesetc.org. Phil, before the break, we were talking about religion in the classroom and the concern that I have to admit I share this concern as well. You look at what happened in overtly religious nations, like nations governed by Sharia law and the Taliban. That I do not want that kind of religion being taught in the classroom. I would prefer an entirely secular outlook to that. Mm-hmm. You said there is a concern here.
Oh, well, yes. And I don't think that teaching religious doctrines in the classroom is what the issue is really about. We shouldn't be doing that. But we should be teaching science honestly. I'm just talking about teaching science. The problem is that our textbooks, our museum exhibits and television programs teach science dishonestly. They attempt to teach the young people that random variations accumulated by natural selection can do all the job of creating. But this claim is not supported by evidence. It's supported by these philosophical rules that, you see, you can only consider random variations and law-like processes. You can't consider evidence for intelligence. If there is evidence pointing to the need for intelligent causes in biology, you're supposed to ignore it. So you see, that's bad science, ignoring evidence and refusing to go where the evidence points. So if the evidence says you need to consider an intelligence, then that isn't going to get our schools into any, you know, into having the Taliban come in and impose their rules or anything else like that. It's just doing science honestly and with an open mind. That's what we need to do.
Would this honest science, if it existed, of necessity need to admit to its own limits, its own ignorance,
yes,
its own the limits of its own potential to answer questions?
Yes, it would. And in the intelligent design movement, as we call it, we make that point very strongly. Science can tell us that its evidence points to the need to consider intelligent causes, and that means a designer, a creator. That's as far as science can go. If you want to know, well, what was that creator like? You know, what Does he care about what human beings do? Is it the God of the Bible, or is it, you know, the Allah of the Quran? That is not the kind of question which science can address. Scientists don't know anything about that, and they shouldn't try to. So that they should just say, our evidence does not support the claim that random variations accumulated by natural selection can do the creating. We used to say that, but we were mistaken. That's what they ought to say. The evidence just does not support the Darwinian theory, and it points to the need to recognize a creative intelligence, and they should just leave it there. That's science operating within proper limits.
Earlier you contrasted two ways of talking about the origin of all things. One that begins with the word. In the beginning was the word, John 1:1, and the other, your own little, as you said, satanic verses that begins with nothing but the particles and the impersonal laws of physics. That second view, that view that is in such great contrast to the revealed, to the biblical view, what meaning does it assign to life now that it is supposedly evolved, imagined God, and put God away in favor of evolution?
Well, there's no meaning to life. Life is something that just happens under the particle story, and there's nothing special about human beings. In the biblical account, and when we start within the beginning of the Word, then we have God creating man in his own image. And man is unique, you see, is qualitatively different from all of the other animals, because only man has rationality and thinking, and only man is created in God's image. But if you take the in the beginning with the particles approach and the evolutionary approach, then man is just one more animal species. And in fact, some of the evolutionary scientists now say that man should just be counted as another chimpanzee. You know, we shouldn't have our own genus, Homo sapiens, the Homo genus to ourselves. We should just be crowded in with the gorillas and the chimpanzees. This way of thinking, that there's nothing special about human beings, leads to such things that are now becoming quite powerful as the animal rights movement. Animals are supposed to have the same rights of people as people, and this is quite an amazing development. And we have organizations like PETA, P-E-T-A, People for the Equal Treatment of Animals. See, that's equal treatment of animals and human beings. They're against such things as meat eating and fur coats and all. And one of the interesting things is they're also against scientific experiments with animals. You can't experiment on scientists. Scientists can't experiment on animals any more freely than they could experiment on human babies, according to this equal treatment of animals rationale. So now this is a great irony. It's something I cover in the first chapter of The Right Questions, that having insisted on this theory of evolution and having insisted on the logical consequence that there's nothing special about human beings, the biological scientists now find that their logic is being used against them and being used to make it very difficult for them to experiment on animals in their laboratories.
To do their science.
Yes.
Very difficult to do their science, in other words.
Yes. But it's logical. You see, if we're all the products of a meaningless, purposeless evolutionary process, then there really is nothing special about human beings.
Philip Johnson, thank you so much for being our guest again on Issues, Etc.
Oh, it was a pleasure to be with you.
Philip Johnson is Professor Emeritus of Law at the University of California at Berkeley and author of several books, including his latest titled The Right Questions, Truth, Meaning, and Public Debate. If one simply goes that far with the big idea of our generation, our era, that is evolution, the big bright idea being that we don't need God in the picture in order to understand ourselves, the meaning of life, any of that. then one will end up with a life that is essentially meaningless, with no significance. And that's a bad place to end. Now, the picture that is painted by the passage that Phil Johnson mentioned so many times during our conversation, the beginning of the Gospel of John, is quite different. Listen to this, merely excerpts that point in an entirely different direction. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him nothing was made that has been made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we have seen his glory, glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. No one has ever seen God at any time. Only the Son, who is at the Father's side, he has made him known. It's one thing to say there must be a God at the beginning of this, and that's a good beginning to make. But we must press on to make known in the public square, to the world, and even among us Christians, that this God simply did not create, that this Word simply does not stand at the beginning of all things, but he has become flesh and dwelt among us and revealed to us who this God really is, far more than just an intelligence, far more than just a designer, but the Father himself, revealed in the Son. Granted, we are granted this knowledge through a real word that he has spoken that really bears his spirit, creates faith in a real person, Jesus Christ, who is at the beginning and the middle and the end of the story. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen to Pastor Todd Wilkin weekly on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Or you can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172. 1-800-737-0172. Visit us this week on the World Wide Web. Our website address, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org.